presenting a new exciting radio program featuring the thrilling adventures of
Comic Dorks!
Many lives would have been lost if Captain America hadn't appeared.
Thrilling adventure and tense excitement, pounding action and spine-tingling mystery.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Comic Dorks, the monthly look at comic books from the perspective of Stephen Schleicher and Scott Johnson. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Scott. How are you?
I am great. It is good to see you. I realize it's a 30-day window between when we speak about these things, but it doesn't feel like that. I feel like we just did the last one.
Yeah, and what's weird is it always seems like all the stuff, all the big important stuff happens like the day or two or the week before we record. So this is perfect.
Yeah, it works out all right. I don't know why we ended up that way, but here we are and we're glad to be here. Thank you all for being here and for your fine feedback lately. We really appreciate it. In fact, real quick here, I'm going to start us off with a slightly different bent than we usually do. I'm going to read an email that was sent to me. If I can find it, here it is. This is from Stefan Vigani, who wrote in and says, Hey, Scott and Steven, I'm watching a few of the old MCU movies and I have a question. How far in advance did they plan out the finer points of the future plot? In Captain America, the Red Skull touches on the Tesseract, the roof of the airship he is in turns into space and is vanished off into some sort of wormhole. It seems an odd detail. So the question is, had they planned for Red Skull to show back up in Guarding the Stone 8 years in advance, or am I just experiencing confirmation bias? Love the show, Stefan. And this is an issue. If you're going to go back and watch MCU movies back from, you know, Iron Man forward, you're going to find stuff where you're like, no, wait a minute. Did they ever address that? Or did that come up again? Or does that break what this future thing is or whatever? So your take on this either in specific or the whole thing at large?
So my understanding is they had major beat points laid out, like these are the major things that have to happen in each film. And I think Kevin Feige has addressed some of this before, where you have these big points. If you listen to Cargill, who is the writer of Doctor Strange, that's the way he was told, is that here are the major beat points that each of these movies have to accomplish in order to get to our big future goal. But then, as far as the minuscule in the weeds kind of stuff, that was left up to each writer and director and creative team to address. So there's maybe a little bit of confirmation bias, but if you were to say, if you were looking at Avengers Endgame and you're like, what's going to happen to Steve Rogers at the end? That stuff was laid out by that creative team, you know, in Captain America: The First Avenger, as far as where his arc would go throughout the entire thing.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't really considered that, but that would make sense. They do strive for consistency, clearly, but there's always going to be holes, like, and some of them more obvious than others. Sometimes it's an actor who doesn't work out, so they bring in Don Cheadle to play
War Machine
as of 2 and forward, because things didn't work out with what's his name from Empire. Can't think of his name either right now. So you're going to have major ones like that that are sort of obvious and you can't avoid, but then you're going to have little things like, where did that character go? Or Red Skull is, where is he now? Well, I guess he's been guarding the Soul Stone. Who guarded it before him? Like, you can start down some pretty gnarly holes. I think that's probably not a healthy endeavor. Probably should just
probably
enjoy
not.
It. Yeah. Just enjoy it. That's what I say.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for that. We will now dive into the content of today's structured show, which looks a lot like this.
Deep in the heart of the city, a clandestine meeting is held by the members of the deadly enemy, the Secret Empire.
J.J. Abrams and his kid, which I just think is interesting because he doesn't really have any comic book writing experience, but whatever. J.J. Abrams and his son are writing a special run on Spider-Man for Marvel Comics. What do we know, and what's the deal with the nepotism I'm smelling here?
Well, I don't know. So let's address the nepotism. First of all, my understanding is that Marvel had been in talks with J.J. Abrams for a long time to say, hey, why don't you come over and work on a comic book project with us? And my understanding is this is like years and years, not like in the last year, but like maybe a decade on and off just talking to J.J. Abrams. Well, finally, they said, hey, came to him again. And he's like, you know what? My son is big into comic books. My son, Henry, how about we team up, father and son come together, and let's create a Spider-Man story for you guys. And Marvel said, okay, sure, what have you got planned? And so the idea is that there is going to be a new villain who will plague both Peter Parker and Spider-Man. They're the same person, but maybe the villain doesn't know that.
Yeah.
But also Mary Jane Watson. And so we're going to see a very different take on what happens when a villain is going after all, quote unquote, three of them. And the villain's name is, what is his name? Cadaverous or something like that.
Yeah, Cadaverous.
So this is a 5-issue miniseries. It begins in September. This announcement came out just last week. There was a big lot of speculation on what was going on because Marvel had sent out this kind of cryptic teaser image of this spider web with the number 4 and then the next day 3. And people were like, oh, my gosh, are they going to do a comic book adaptation of the fourth Spider-Man movie that never came to be? And then some people thought that it was Spider-Man joining the Fantastic Four and Dan Slott would be working with that. And so a lot of people got hooked up or riled up about it. It would have been nice if it had turned into a Spider-Ham kind of tease because, you know, the whole Charlotte's Web with spiders and spelling out things and those kind of stuff.
Sure. And has JJ had any experience previous to this with comics? Is this the first time?
Not to my knowledge. So okay. I think this is his first time coming into the comic book world. But as far as some nepotism goes, there's some weirdness too. Sure. His son, Henry Abrams, working with him on that. But then you also have to take into account that JJ has been working on the Star Wars films for the last couple of versions. Which is owned by Disney, and Disney now owns Marvel. So there may be some internal nepotism going on as well, but internally in the company.
Yeah.
But I think this is going to be really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm curious about it. I mean, I at least want to see what comes of it. He's a great storyteller.
Yes. He is a big fan of the mystery box, of course. Mm-hmm. And so some of his endings do not always stick, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because of that.
Yeah. Because it's hard to, boy, that really paints yourself in a corner, doesn't it? When you've got something that's first of all, a mystery box, if you play it up too much, never can quite live up to what the lead up was. It's a dangerous trope. I don't know why he does that so often.
Yeah, does. The other thing that's speaking of tropes, the other big thing is J.J. Abrams, well known for his lens flares in his films. And so when this was announced, I was like, okay, who's the artist on this? And it's Sarah Pichelli, who's a great artist. She did the Ultimate Spider-Man comics with Brian Michael Bendis for decades. Well, shouldn't be a decade, but for years. And I was like, are they going to put in lens flares? And we haven't seen any of the interior pages, but the cover definitely has some lens flares on it, Scott.
Yeah. See, that's either a sign of, I don't know what that's a sign of.
I don't know, but the cover isn't Sarah Pichelli. The cover is by Olivier Coipel.
Right.
But still, the lens flares from the eyes.
Yeah. Look, 2009 is not as far away as we remember. And boy, let those lens flares fly, I suppose. you know, whatever. I'm willing to read this and see how it goes. I did some looking into, we talked about this on TMS this morning, but I looked into who his son is just to kind of see, well, maybe he's got the comics chops or there's some sort of connection there. Can't really find one. He's young. He's like 21. He's got some credits on IMDb that are mostly helping on set for his dad's movies. Not any writing credits I can find. So I don't know what the and son part's for, but maybe he's brilliant and it will change the world of comics forever. I don't know.
So Henry has this article over at the New York Times. This is where the story broke. And he says, I feel like I've developed not just as a writer, but someone who can appreciate stories more. Spider-Man is one of those superheroes where the more you read about him, for me at least, the less I understand. He's so anti everything that you'd expect from a hero. I think Stan Lee said something about putting the human in superhuman. That's what we're trying to do here. So I have a feeling that it is a lot of father-son. I don't want to say father-son bonding, but, you know, Scott, if you had a chance, if someone came to you or your son came to you, if Nick came to you and said, Dad, I want to do a World of Warcraft game type game, and I want you to develop the story with me and you and I can work together to develop the characters. And I know, Dad, that you've got an in with Blizzard. Can we make this a storyline in World of Warcraft? You would probably drop everything and make that happen.
Of course I would. Yeah, any dad would. Like, I don't begrudge them that at all. Like, I think that's, you know, you get the opportunity to go for it.
I think there's probably a little bit of that going on here.
Probably. And that's fine. Like, that's actually cool. I'll look forward to it. When's the date? When do we get this?
September. So okay. The solicitations just dropped last Friday. The previews catalog is out. The way a direct market comic shops work is you have to order your comics 3 months in advance. Not saying that comic shops are not going to order this. They'll probably order some, but if you want to be guaranteed to get a copy of this, you need to order 3 months in advance. Go visit your local comic shop, put your order in. They will get it out to you when the issue arrives in September, whatever the exact date is. But it's probably second week in September.
You suspect high demand on this one? You think it'll be?
I think so, just from name. And I'm thinking that's what, you know, there's a lot of stunt casting going on here. And I think that's what Marvel and what comic shops and what Diamond are hoping for, is to get a lot of hype about this. A lot of fans of J.J. Abrams. J.J. is, you know, your son's generation, Steven Spielberg. Mm-hmm. So there probably is going to be a lot of demand for this.
Yeah, I think so too. I don't think, by the way, I've got no problem with comic books version of stunt casting, either in the pages or out. Like, it's good for the industry to catch your eye, to push people to go, oh yeah, I should probably pick that. I haven't read Spider-Man in years. Like, what you got to do whatever you got to do in comics to keep that art form going. And I don't think it strikes me as desperate. It just seems like smart marketing. And it's not like, you know, JJ's not sitting around with nothing to do. He's very busy and makes a crap ton of money for the work he does. This sounds more like a passion project. And that's meaningful on its own level. So
Definitely.
We shall see how it goes. Now, in somewhat worser news, disgusting news. Sad news. Sure. Sad. Yes. DC is shutting down Vertigo, which really bums me out, but also DC Inc. and DC Zoom. Now, I'm not as familiar with those other two sort of...
Yeah, so this is a really crazy kind of story, because DC Inc. and DC Zoom were announced 2 years ago at the San Diego Comic-Con. I get these backwards. DC Inc. is supposed to be the YA targeted audience, stories there, and DC Zoom is supposed to be the little kid audience. And they were creating a lot of properties for this. It was a year later that the first books were announced. And I want to say like 2 or 3 months ago, the first books started arriving under these two imprints. Vertigo has been around since the 90s. This is where you've got your Swamp Things and your Sandman and your Hellblazer and all this stuff. These adult themed titles that have made, you know, these avant-garde, these out there things that really made comic books more mainstream for adult audiences. And so just last week, DC announced that they were going to shut down DC Inc., DC Zoom, and Vertigo, and they were going to put them into three different categories of comics. DC Kids, which would be basically your DC Inc. and your DC Zoom. Your DC Comics, which is going to be your regular, you know, 14-plus type stuff. And then another imprint that they had announced over a year ago, the DC Black Label, which was going to be home for mature comics. Now, the Black Label, if you go back and look at the history of some of the things that have gone on there, they've only released one book under the DC Black Label line, and that was Batman Damned, that came out, I want to say like 6 months, 8 months ago, that got a lot of controversy because there's a silhouette of Batman's wiener as he's taking off his clothes and running through the Batcave.
Yeah, I remember talking about this. Yeah.
So a lot of people, I think, are kind of upset that they could have just kept it DC Vertigo and moved all of the mature reader line underneath that. But I think people, and this is partly DC's fault from years ago, because they created DC Vertigo specifically to do adult stuff that was not part of the main DC universe. So that's why you had Swamp Thing and you had John Constantine over there on the Vertigo side. Well, in recent years, there's been this kind of demand about, can't we bring Hellblazer? Can't we bring him into the main DCU? Can't we bring Swamp Thing in for these stories about the Green? Can't we just feature a Sandman appearance? And DC has been really resistant to that until, I want to say maybe in the last 4 years, where they've started to allow some of that to happen. And so there has been this question of, well, why are we doing DC Vertigo? If we're just going to incorporate all these adult characters into the DC comics, why can't we just put everything under an adult label line? And that's what they're doing here. But this is, I think, kind of a real shame. And I think we want to talk about this maybe a little bit more in a few minutes, to talk about what does it mean when Vertigo ends, and maybe recommend some Vertigo books that have been around and have become kind of like, when it comes to comic books and people are talking about adult read comic books, Vertigo is right there and has some top titles in there.
Oh, yeah. No, historically, we'll be remembered as a really important phase, like, and it's a long phase. Like, it felt permanent. Like, we would never not have Vertigo. So I'm I'm a real bummed to hear this. But at the same time, you know, as if they're going to continue to foster smart, mature writing for a more adult audience and just do that on, in a different way, then maybe it's just like losing a logo or something. It's not that big a deal, but
They've also lost two of their big editors on that series. Years ago, Karen Berger, she was there from, I think, the very beginning and really brought in Sandman and Neil Gaiman and Garth Ennis and all of those guys. She left, and now she's doing Black Crown over at IDW Publishing.
Right.
And then like a year or so ago, they let go the other editor who was kind of heralding in the second generation of Vertigo Books. And when they let her go, it kind of was a sign that they didn't really know what to do with Vertigo Books without those two editors there. So that may also be another part of this story that we're not familiar with.
The thing with DC Ink and DC Zoom, it never really
Never really had a chance to blossom and to test themselves out before DC was just like, you know what? We're going to just do this thing. Now, the other thing, the third thing to kind of keep in mind in this is Diane Nelson was let go as the president of the DC and merchandising group 2 years ago, and a new person has come in. And one thing we've always learned when new people come in to take over as a CEO or the head of something is they tend to wipe out everything that came before that.
Yeah,
so I don't know
true.
If there's some of that going on as well.
They could be. They think it's even if they don't know they're doing it, it's a way for them to prove that they're bringing big changes. So this is true everywhere. Like every company, if somebody comes in that's like new ownership, you're just hold on to your butts because you're about to lose about half your stuff. And then they'll create a bunch of new things that some other future CEO will get rid of as well. That's just
correct.
That's the cycle. Yep. All right. So if you're into Spawn, which is now a very old comic. I remember back when it was brand new and felt like it was the new kid on the block.
Over 25 years ago, Scott, you're old.
It's a long time. Jeez.
I know.
I was there day one, picked up issue one at
Me
my
too.
Local shop. And I thought it was a huge deal. Still is kind of, but, it's going to hit 300 issues next month in August.
Mm-hmm.
Freaking 100 issues. Now, this is special for a couple of reasons. One, obviously, 300 is huge. But 300 is going to bring back the talents of comic creator Todd McFarlane, who created Spawn in the first place, and helped found Image, and Greg Capullo coming back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now, Capullo didn't start doing the art on Spawn.
No,
that was McFarlane that did that initially in, the first 10 issues or something like that.
Yeah.
But then Capullo came in and that creative team right there ran for a long time and really, I think, made Spawn a big hit for a number of people.
Mm-hmm. His art was really transcendent for me. I don't know what it is about Capullo's particular brand of art. It translated well for Spawn and the existing style, but it also was its own thing in its own way. And I just have followed him ever since and love his work. So good.
Yeah. And if anyone has ever read the Scott Snyder, Greg Capullo run on Batman and everything that those two have done together, that style just continues to improve and get better and better and better. And Capullo and, as you said, McFarlane are coming back for the 300th issue. And when issue 301 drops in September, Spawn will be the longest running indie comic book out there.
Wow.
Yeah, and it'll set a record with issue 301.
That's how you know it's not new anymore.
I know, right?
It's definitely a sign that is a seasoned old thing. I mean, I don't even know what it reads like these days. I haven't read it in so long. I'm sure it's gone places. I mean, we have the benefit sometimes with DC and Marvel, they'll reset things, you know? I don't know if that's happened to Spawn much. Do you know if they've...
I have not been a big fan of Spawn, so even after the initial run, and we went back and revisited the first trade paperback of Spawn not too long ago on the Major Spoilers podcast, I really, when I look back, I bought those issues for the pretty art and not for the story.
Story's not great. Early story.
Yeah, and I haven't really followed it since probably issue 20.
Yeah. It feels like a comic that probably got better in other people's hands. I really like McFarlane as a creator, as a visionary, and as an artist, but I never really could get behind his writing's always been kind of bad.
Yeah.
Sort of with whatever he's working on.
I mean, it's there. It's
fine.
You know, it's passable,
usable,
right?
Usable. Sure. It's fine, but it's got a very throwaway early 90s heavy metal kind of vibe to it. It's just like none of this matters, you know, like you kind of get that feeling. But with that new movie coming out, perhaps there's a chance here for some sort of rebirth.
We still have about a year before that movie is supposed to come out, although I don't think they've even finished the script or gotten approval to move forward with that movie.
No, the whole thing sounds a little fuzzy Like there's, yeah, you know, he announced it on a freaking Instagram post and outside of, I can't remember where that was outside of the, it was some kind of thing. Oh, it was Comic-Con.
Yeah. It was, I think it was Images Comic-Con or something.
Yeah. And they were outside and Kevin Smith interviewed him or something and they did some kind of thing. It all felt very, not low rent. I'm all about this sort of grassroots thing, but it just felt like, oh, you guys aren't getting real producers or anything here, are you? You're just going to just gonna wing this thing. It does say that McFarlane was planning on drawing 301, so he's going to get back in the artist chair for that issue.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That'll be interesting. I could tell toward the end of his run of being the main artist on the series that he was running out of steam.
If you haven't, follow him on Instagram, because he occasionally will do some Instagram live streams where he will sit down and draw and say,
he'll teach you how to draw eyes
weekly for a while.
Yeah, he did eyes one day. I tuned in live and taught basically how to do a good comic book eye and to do it very quickly. And it was almost anime-ish in terms of this huge eye he was drawing. But he'll just get in front of his Wacom and do like a little tutorial. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really neat to follow him.
I got to interview him years ago on Extra Life Radio, and it was one of my favorite things I ever did. And he's a fascinating human being. Like, it's not just simply, oh, he's a good artist. Oh, he can write a comic book or, oh, whatever. He is just this all-in-one, very unusual combination of left brain, right brain, business savvy.
And if you go and look at the history of Image Comics, you know, it's, you know, all of the creators that founded it, the two that are still basically there are Todd and Eric Larson.
Yep.
The rest, Jim Lee is over at DC as the co-editor. Rob Liefeld is back at Marvel and doing his own thing. Those two that stick around really have a vision.
Mark Silvestri, where'd he go? Did he take off?
Is doing a lot of stuff with Top Cow. Okay. I mean, which is basically an imprint of Image.
Yeah, it's kind of a spinoff.
Mm-hmm.
I always loved his stuff. Darkness is great.
Yeah.
Like it's interesting to see them all do that, right? Like they've kind of all gotten back to where they left, in better positions, give or take. But McFarlane and Larson especially, that dude just planted his flag and sat. He didn't go anywhere. Yeah. He's like, you know what? I'm going to make Savage Dragon till I die.
Yep.
And never leave him.
Oh boy. Oh boy. If you haven't read Savage Dragon lately.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Really?
He had some content that one of the I think Diamond basically said, this is a little bit more adult than what we're used to. And he's like, okay, if I'm going to be tagged as an adult comic, I'm going to lean into the adult.
Mm. Yeah. He has a funny attitude.
Yeah.
I don't know if funny is the right word, but yeah.
I think that's probably the best word to use right there.
Yeah. Still a very
a different approach.
Yeah. A very talented dude. Very focused on the one thing he wanted to do and said, you know what? I'm going to make Savage Dragon. Really? Yes. How long? The rest of my life.
Yeah. It's creator owned. He gets after expenses, he writes, he draws, he gets 100% of that. So
Does he sell? I mean, how does Savage Dragon do generally? Is it a popular
comic? I want to say it is in the mid range. I think if you look at the top 500, it's at least consistently in the top 150.
Mm. Okay.
Which means, you know, anywhere from 3 to 10,000 issues.
Interesting. It is an 18 plus comic now.
Yeah. Oh, like, yeah. There was a whole line that dealt with lots of sex with lots of people.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well done, Eric Larson. You crazy, bald, crazy guy. All right. Not that bald has anything to do with it. I'm just reveling in the fact that I've been taking these. So my wife makes me take these weird, I don't know what they even are. They're these weird gummies, but they've got they've got the chemical that normally you produce naturally to just grow nail and hair and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, I'm not really losing my hair necessarily, but I started eating these and I am a weed now. Just my hair is always growing. Just like you can see.
You'll have to tell me what that is offline so I can fill in this bald patch.
It's a weird thing, dude. I'll send you this. I forget what it's called.
Okay.
This isn't like some weird supplement.
It's not like Propecia or something.
No,
like that.
No, none of that. And it was only like she was taking them for her nails and she says, well, it's supposed to be for hair too. Do you want to try it? I'm like, yeah, I guess so. I'm not really, not really receding, but maybe we'll see. And now I'm like, I got to get a haircut like twice as often as I used to. And it's crazy. Hey, Kim, what's that stuff called? My wife just walked in. What's the name of that stuff that you eat that gets your hair longer? Biotin? biotin.
Biotin.
And it's a natural thing your body makes, but as you get older, it makes less. And so you eat these gummies, and now I'm a weed.
Okay.
Hair, skin, and nails. Yeah, that's usually what you see it under in the store. Anyway, so you'll grow more skin. Maybe we could be our own comic book heroes.
I need less skin, not more skin.
Yeah, God. More skin, less skin. Who knows? Let's move on to, and congrats to them on the
Spawn.
On Spawn, yes. That's what I was trying to say. Thank you for clearing that up. Let's talk about Dark Horse and them losing someone, another loss in the industry.
So this was announced back in February that Stan Sakai, long-time creator of the Usagi Yojimbo series, the anthropomorphic rabbit in feudal Japan. It was announced, and I don't want to say he started it at Dark Horse, but I mean, basically, since Dark Horse was there, Stan Sakai was there as well. But it was announced back in February that he was leaving Dark Horse to take Usagi Yojimbo over to IDW Publishing.
Uh-huh.
And last week, the first issue of that dropped at IDW Publishing. And as always, it's Stan Sakai, so you know it's great.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just a really kind of an amazing, weird moment. I know Dark Horse has kind of had some issues in losing properties. I mean, they lost basically everything in the Star Wars move years ago, and they were poised, and I don't know what the current situation is with the Fox properties now that Disney has acquired them as well, and then to lose Stan Sakai, and it's just like, oh my gosh, what is going on with Dark Horse? But for Stan Sakai fans and Usagi Yojimbo fans, that first issue turned out to be really, really good over at IDW.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, Dark Horse in general has become, they lose the Star Wars stuff. They mm-hmm. lose people, they lose creative IP, they lose all this stuff, and I don't know how they're still publishing. It's great to see these guys move on to somewhere where they can flourish, but the underlying story here is is Dark Horse's days more numbered than I thought?
I don't know if they're, wouldn't say numbered as far as they're going to close up shop, although that could happen, but they used to be consistently the number three publisher of comic books, and now 6, 7, 8? Is where they normally fall. Boom Studios, IDW, Image Comics can routinely beat them in a month of late releases. Now, Dark Horse still has Hellboy for now. They still have a lot of really great other creator-owned projects or creator projects from Cullen Bunn and others that are very, very good. And what Dark Horse really consistently excels at right now is the art books that they produce, and a lot of the art books that they produce with video game companies. So if you're looking for the art of, I don't know if they've done this, but like Art of Red Dead Redemption 2, that's what I'm currently playing.
Mm-hmm.
They will put out a fantastic art book on this mm-hmm. that looks at behind the scenes stuff, you know, artist renditions of stuff, these kinds of things. So for me, that's kind of where Dark Horse is really got a good, strong foothold is in these ancillary video game book market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. It's fascinating. Where is mm-hmm. Hellboy right now?
Hellboy is still at Dark Horse.
Okay, so that's kind of their big title, right? Like, what else?
They've got that. They've got the Aliens line. They've got Game of Thrones is at Dynamite, but they have the Game of Thrones licensing for merchandise stuff.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even know they were doing. I didn't know there was a Game of Thrones comic. How dumb is that?
I think it's Dynamite that's been doing it. It may have been Dark Horse, but it's been a very good straight up adaptation of the books.
Yeah, because they used to be, they were the go to for your licensed movie stuff mm-hmm. and things like that, and you could always count on a really good quality treatment. The AVP stuff on there was always really good.
Yeah, they've still got, as far as we know right now, they still are printing Aliens comic books. They just were doing the Aliens 3 movie adaptation, the one that never got made,
mm-hmm.
Into a comic book, as well as an Aliens versus Predators, and there's Colonial Marines and a couple of others that they still have going strong.
Yeah, Colonial Marines was great. That was a really good, I mean, the bits mm-hmm. that I read. Well, all mm-hmm. right, maybe they're fine. I don't know, man. I just keep hearing about these other studios scooping up really great creators or really big IPs, and I think their days are numbered, and why aren't they as prolific as they used to be, and it just kind of bums me out. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I really think it started when Disney kind of yanked out the Disney owned stuff that they were doing, like the Cars and that kind of stuff. Cars was over at Boom, so don't at me. But those kind of properties that they had kind of yanked out of Dark Horse, and then immediately when Lucasfilm bought it, everyone was like, oh, does this mean that you know, Star Wars is going back to Marvel. And for a couple of months, Dark Horse was like, nope. But then as soon as that license agreement, that contract came up, it was announced that Star Wars would no longer be at Dark Horse. And that's when they started to take a tumble.
Well, yeah, I just have hope. I'm holding that hope, man, that they're going to be okay. Hey, this is a big one for you. Okay, we've talked about all the things that are leaving. Now let's talk about something that's coming back, and you couldn't be more excited about it. Tell me about the Legion of Superheroes.
I am so excited about this. I called it when Brian Michael Bendis was announced that he was going to be moving over to DC. I announced that he would be taking over the Superman title, and sure enough, he took over Action Comics. And then if you follow him on Twitter, now right now you can't really follow him on his own main page. He's been hacked. And they're trying to get back a lot of his social media presence. But if you follow him over the last, I want to say 6 months, he's been dropping these little Legion of Superheroes. Like, here's a portion of the logo. Here's a little symbol of somebody, or he'll post a toy picture of the Legion. I'm like, oh, they are getting ready to announce Legion of Superheroes. And I thought that they were going to wait until the San Diego Comic-Con, but nope. They announced last week, just ahead of the solicitations that were coming out in September, the Legion of Superheroes are coming back with Brian Michael Bendis writing and Ryan Sook doing the art. Now, the Legion of Superheroes, a big fan favorite of mine. This is a team of teenage superheroes from all over the, I guess we'll say the universe, that have teamed together to protect the United Planets. Mm-hmm. And so they started back in the 1950s, 1958 to be exact. And through the years, their roster has grown in size. They did a reboot in 94. They did a three-boot in 2004. They had a very short post-crisis run in 2007. But they've kind of stumbled, in my opinion, since the three-boot, or prior to the three-boot, the 90s reboot. Mm. They've kind of stumbled a little bit in being able to capture the magic and the spirit of what made the Legion of Superheroes cool. And I think that with Brian Michael Bendis coming on board, I think we're going to see some very, very cool stories. And I'm very excited about this when this launches in September, called Millennium, The Legion of Superheroes, which will be a two-part story that will then lead into an ongoing series. But there's one of the things that I always loved about The Legion of Superheroes is that they, whether they knew it or not, the writers were kind of tackling some themes of the day. So, for example, Otto Binder, who was the original creator, the original writer of the Legion of Superheroes. In the group of kids that were in charge of the Legion when it started, you had Cosmic Boy, who had magnetic powers. You had Lightning Lad, who had electricity powers. And then you had Saturn Girl, who had telekinetic or telepathy powers. You know, mm-hmm. She could read your mind.
Sure.
At the time, to have a woman or a teenage girl as a integral part of the leadership of a team probably would have been unheard of in the 1958. She became president of the Legion for many years before Karate Kid and others took over. So there are some very progressive moments in the Legion of Superheroes. There's also a lot of, like, sometimes cringeworthy moments of the Legion of Superheroes, just in the way that they were trying to deal with certain topics of the time and then just totally falling on their face. Mm. There was one run that stands out in my mind, or one issue that stands out in my mind, where you can read this any way you like, but suddenly the girls of the team were overcome with a crimson colored affliction, and they were sent away for a month until it was taken care of.
Whoa.
And you can kind of read that as some possible bodily functions that would be natural for women. Yeah. And then, you know, just in the way that it's written, maybe it wasn't intentional, but boy, it really makes you fall flat on your face when you see it in the light of today. So I do a podcast, another show called The Legion Clubhouse, in which Matthew Peterson and I are going through issue by issue of every appearance of the Legion of Superheroes and looking at it through the lens of today. Like, oh, what was going on in the racial department of the 1960s, and how is that reflected in the comics? There was a really good issue that looked at homelessness and people who are poor in the 30th century, and how is that reflective of today? So we've had a lot of fun in doing that, and I cannot wait for the Legion to return in September. I'm hoping it's so good. It's like the last one, a lot of people kind of, you know, pulled their collars away and were like, nyeh. But I really have a lot of hope riding on this new series being fantastic.
That's great. I don't know that I've ever heard you so passionate about a thing coming back. You're stoked.
I have been, you know, it's funny because the Major Spoilers podcast, we've been talking about the Legion on and off. I think it was like the third or fourth episode, Matthew and I got together and it's like, oh, someday we'd love to do a Legion of Superheroes podcast. And it took like 10 years later before we were finally able to do that. So yeah, it's great. The Legion is just fantastic. It's goofy. Everybody has a unique power. You've got some crazy names like Triplicate Girl or Duo Damsel or Bouncing Boy. A lot of people look at horrible superheroes. So sometimes you'll see Arm Fall Off Boy. That was one character in one panel from one issue of the Legion of Superheroes. Yeah. And today it's still, I think, the most influential team right up there next to the Avengers and the Justice League. You've got to count the Legion of Superheroes.
Yeah. Since I never really dug into it, I feel like I've been remiss, and now I'm excited about a modern take, and I'm also kind of curious about the old stuff. I need to listen to that. People are going to hear this and go, Legion Clubhouse, what a deep cut. You guys are really getting down to the
meat of the bone. It is. Yeah.
But that's what's great about a lot of the stuff in your roster over there is you guys go real deep on some specific stuff. I guarantee there are going to be some Legion fans. Or some who don't know that they're going to be that would love that. So do check that out over there.
Yeah, and in the first 10-ish, the first 10 episodes, we've got some really good interviews. We interview the person who wrote the biography of Otto Bender, who also created Shazam. Mm-hmm. So we've got a lot of stuff going on there. We've got some other interviews planned coming up. I'd love to get Gail Simone on, who's worked with the Legion. I'd love to get Jeff Moy, who did the art for the Legion for a long time. And I might be trying to get a Brian Michael Bendis to come on and talk about his love of the Legion before that series drops in September.
That'd be awesome, dude.
Yeah. Let's
make that happen. All right. Here's a funny, well, not funny. Here's the thing we're going to do.
Okay.
We're going to go
down quick, because I've got to run.
We're going to go down memory lane. This will be very fast. Okay. We're going to have a little theme music for it. Let's talk about Vertigo books we're going to miss. I mean, for me, it's easily Sandman and Why the Last Man, because they're the only two I remember reading from the label. I'm sure I've read others and just didn't realize it was Vertigo, which may actually just prove their point that they don't need the name anymore. I don't know, but
maybe so. Why the Last Man is perfect. Sandman is perfect. If you can get the omnibus editions or the absolute editions of those are great. My favorite Fables, my favorite Vertigo book is Fables from Bill William, where it asks the question of, what if those fairy tales you read as a kid were actually true and those people had to escape the fairyland and move to our world? What would that be like? And what would happen when the conflict from the Fables lands come here? That was always fantastic. Transmetropolitan, if you're a journalist or any kind of a newspaper fan, go read Transmetropolitan. It is fantastic as well. And then American Vampire. Hey, Scott Snyder, I think it's great. No, Raphael Albuquerque.
Oh, right.
On that. Yeah. Total cool series.
Swamp Thing was that the Alan Moore?
Yep.
That
was at DC before they moved it over to Vertigo. But yeah, there's been a lot of great Swamp Thing stuff over there.
Yeah, I also Preacher and Hellblazer. I guess I did read those, and I forgot I forgot those were Vertigo. In fact, I forgot they were DC in general. Maybe that's part of the problem.
That could be, and that's maybe a longer discussion right there.
Yeah, we'll do that on a different day. That's going to do it for the show. Thank you all for joining us. Hopefully, you've enjoyed this trip down memory lane as well as our coverage of the news. If you like us, go check us out at comicdorks.com. Review us on your favorite podcatcher apps and stores. We'd love that. Email us, comicdorks@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter at comicdorks. And, of course, more stuff like this at frogpants.com. And do check out majorspoilers.com. Steven, it has been my pleasure today. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it always is. Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, thank you, guys. We'll see you next month. Goodbye.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Really?